Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. And yes, you don't have to look at your calendar. I've been with you 2 weeks in a row. It's because Chris and I needed to shift a few things around. Chris Kington Barker will be back with you next week. Our goal on Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how things that may change will have long-term ramifications, or in some cases, how lack of change may have long-term ramifications. Our topic today is interesting and unusual, and probably when I was just speaking with our guest a little while ago, one of the most nebulous things we've probably talked about, that is, what does it mean to be an American now? And it's an interesting topic. This week, once again, we're participating along with other NPR member stations in a National Week of Conversation. The National Weeks of Conversation are called A Nation Engaged. In past weeks, we've discussed what is America's place in the world. We've discussed economic opportunities in America. And as we continue our collaboration as part of NPR's special reporting project, I want to have you join us today for what I've said to you was going to be an interesting topic, and that is, what does it mean to be an American now? Joining me today is Dr. Paul Georgiou. He's a retired emergency room physician who's lived in San Luis Obispo County for 35 years. He's a son of Belgium Cypriot immigrants, and we'll clarify why we think that's part of really a key part of the discussion a little later on. Dr. Steve Lloyd Moffat, who's a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly, and he's the co-founder of the Lavra, an intentional community in Arroyo Grande, and we'll find out what an intentional community means also in the process. And Sam Holzer, she's a fourth-year history major in a minor in art history and women's and gender studies. And that's an error I apologize for, but okay. We'll talk about that, of course, too. And she is president of the Cal Poly chapter of TRIATA, which is the National Gender Studies Honor Society. And this is, we've never before had a topic I would put in the category of the guests, please, please, please tell us what you want us to talk about, because this is probably one of the most unusual things we've ever had to look at. Paul, I'm going to start with you. Only because by nature of the fact that you are a second-generation immigrant from an immigrant family, I think that becomes a big factor in what we're talking about as to what it means to be an American. And I'm wondering, when you've had this question posed to you before about, gee, where did your parents come from? What's your background? It's probably come up oftentimes in a positive environment, but I'm sure a number of times it's come up in a negative environment. So I think I'd like to start there.
Oh, thank you, Fred. This is something that's a very, very personal topic for me, is because my earliest childhood memory, though I was born in the United States, I was raised on the island of Cyprus, was in the dark being awakened by my parents, held up to a porthole, and seeing the Statue of Liberty lit up at night. And the reason why I still remember it vividly to this day was because my parents were both crying. And that is what America's always meant to me, as a symbol of hope. A symbol. It's not perfect. It's evolving. And I think so much of what defined being an American for my parents, and they passed that on to me and my sister, is something that it's a dream. It's an aspiration, an ideal. And it's the fact that we keep striving towards it. That's what makes us American. But again, my perspective is different. Now, I'm fortunate to be married to somebody whose family goes back to the Mayflower and the American Revolution. And I'm fascinated to hear her stories as well. But I have a more, I think, palpable appreciation of what it is to be an American, being the son of immigrants.
When your parents came to the United States, And I have to clarify, I often try and say the word United States as opposed to America because I wonder about the people who are not from the United States who are concerned that we've co-opted the word American. So I'm not quite sure where that fits anymore. When you go to somewhere, as I've been before, in Central America, they will generally remind you that you're not an American, you're a North American, and they would prefer the differentiation. What motivated your family to come here, and what was behind that?
Their motivations were, and everybody has their own story. For my parents, it was opportunity. It was also a dream of freedom. I mean, my mother, happiest day of her life was when the first American troops came down her street and liberated her from Nazi occupation. For my father, as an academician, it was to come back to get his PhD at the University of California at Berkeley and pursue his studies, opportunities he would never have had on his native island. They were part of what they called the brain drain that happened after World War II, where the United States kind of skimmed off a lot of the intellectuals from Europe. But for them, it was a chance to live really a dream. I think this discussion we're going to have today is going to elaborate on that, what it is. It's individual to each and every one of us what is it truly means to be an American.
Thank you.
If I could add, Fred, I've known Dr. Paul for more than a decade, and one of the reasons that I really encourage him to be a part of the conversation is because in many ways he embodies what I think of what it means to be American, because he is clearly an American. He does so much good for our community and for our country, but he's never forgot where he came from, too. So he will lead Greek dances, and he's one of the greatest Greek dancers on the West Coast. But he can also do American swing and every other kind of American dance as well. And to me, that sort of dual personality, that dual consciousness of being, yes, I am American, but I know where I came from, so much represents what it means to be American.
I can't help but say this. I'm a native-born American, and I can't dance at all. And Steve, we'll get back to that, and I think there's more to be said for that in a little bit. Sam, I want to put you on the spot a little bit. I mean, it's when we're dealing with topics like this, there's a perception that that young people have an opinion, mm-hmm. and the perception is, yeah, but they'll tell us later. And I think that becomes a tough one to look at. You're dealing with a society that that probably presents some interesting challenges to you and issues of identity that you're working through. Yeah. I'm wondering sometimes if as an American you look from a standpoint of this is what I'd prefer America would leave me alone about or support me about, as opposed to what mm-hmm. you already feel supported or cared about in a country like this.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think just to kind of continue Paul's train of thought, that my great-grandparents were at this point, because they have passed away, Russian Jews who escaped the pogroms in Russia and Belarus as well. And so I think that America absolutely symbolizes a sense of potential and opportunity that I wouldn't have had in another country. Living as a transgender individual in 21st century America, I think is very different than living at another time in American history. I know that my choices are more societally accepted than they would be at another point in American history. But I know at the same time that I have had, both physical limitations in terms of accessing medical care, but I've also had, social limitations in terms of coming out to friends and family. And so I think that America as a melting pot and a meeting place of ideas is working towards opportunities for all and working towards hopefully the embrace of the other or the stranger or the neighbor.
Yeah. I'm going to get back to that in a second. I want to remind folks that this is a call-in program and you're welcome to call and be part of the dialogue. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. 3875. The number doesn't change. So if you write it down now, it'll be the same number we'll offer to have you call in next week. And I encourage you to call in early in the program, especially with a topic that has such nebulous possibilities as this one does. If you want to be part of the discussion, the earlier in the program you call in, the more likely we'll have time for you to be part of that discussion. Sam, there's a part of my thoughts about America that concern me, and that is the good news is we're an evolving enough country that for most Americans, how we treat and how we evolve respect for transgender people or people who are just different than us.
Yeah.
Is becoming less of a hurdle to go over. Mm-hmm. There are countries in the world, as you know, where your current life would basically get you killed instantly.
Yeah.
There's other countries that your current life would get the response of, and why did anybody in North America find you to be unusual?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you've looked at that from a historical perspective. You are a history major.
Yes.
Okay, so and I'm wondering how that's fit into your perspective of being an American.
My specific study of history, and actually what I'm working on in my senior project right now, is kind of the contemporary depiction of both women's bodies and then the queer and the trans body in contemporary art, looking at a lot of kind of contemporary gender theory and things like that. And, you know, I don't need to delve necessarily too deeply into those topics, but I do think looking at the actual kind of course of history that the rights movements, specifically for the gay rights movements, have often been very volatile and have been really, especially with the AIDS crisis, you know, approximately 20 to 30 years ago, a very kind of tragic mark on America's past. You know, not really, at least in my opinion, heavily investing in kind of the public health infrastructure that would have saved a lot of LGBTQ individuals, or at least helped them to live somewhat better lives. And so I think that there are kind of these moments in America's past where, to a certain extent today, we're trying to right those wrongs, and we're trying to draw more people into the fold of America and show them that as much as there might have been missteps in the past, that we are willing to extend, you know, the hand of acceptance. I mean, there was a transgender woman at the Democratic National Convention that happened, 2-3 months ago at this point, who spoke on the stage and spoke about her experience in America. And so I think that is kind of a remarkable moment of progress.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Steve, we haven't given you much chance to talk yet, but you've got a lot to say, I know, because I know you. The evolving perception of the world we live in and the evolving perception of the country we live in is probably something that comes up in a lot of issues for you and your students. How do you see where we are as a country, and how do you see where we are as our identity as Americans?
Yeah, thanks, Fred. I mean, I think if we want to go back to what it means to be American, the only pure Americans are the indigenous Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, they are the original Americans, and everybody who's come has begun as a hyphenated American.
Mm-hmm.
So our first people who came here were European colonist Americans. Then over time, they became European Americans, and then they became just Americans. And that has happened throughout our time. And when we go back historically, you were first an Irish American or an Irish Catholic, and then a Polish Catholic, and those were different identities. And over time, those converge into just being American or just being Catholic. And so what I think you see in the trajectory of America is that we slowly lose our hyphenated status. And over the long haul, America has moved towards enlarging that category of what it just means to be American. And so for a while, you come in and they're Mexican Americans. And over time, it's you're just an American. And we struggle each time we lose a hyphenation.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of the trajectory of our nation, that we are evolving into an identity that we you know, that wasn't there at the beginning. A few days ago, NPR had a story with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Scalia, and I remember Scalia was talking about, well, you know, Americans passed the Constitution. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, well, to be clear, male property-owning Americans mm-hmm. passed that Constitution. Mm-hmm. And her point, I think, is very true, is that, you know, our idea of what it means to be American has expanded over time. And that's the trajectory. And as Dr. Paul said, we haven't always been perfect in this. And Sam pointed out, you know, tragic parts of our past where we haven't lived up to those ideals. But I think the trajectory is always very clear. We are evolving into a definition of what it means to be an American that includes more and more people into that category.
You talked about the hyphen, okay, mm-hmm. which I'm glad you did talk about the hyphen, because I think that particular issue becomes something that's disturbing to me, and I think it's disturbing to others sometimes. I would suggest to you that when we're all immigrants, okay, with the exception of Native Americans, and thank mm-hmm. you for bringing that up, because I think that's a very, very clear point. So we all started out as something that was – or our families started out as something that was hyphenated. I find it interesting that it seems when the hyphen goes away for a lot of people, their tolerance goes away with it. And I'm wondering how any of you may see that as a factor. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, my father was of Scottish background. Mm-hmm. My mother was Polish background. It was a discussion I had with my father quite a bit. He said because his parents migrated not from Scotland, but his great-grandparents did. His parents actually migrated from Nova Scotia. And this was in the early 20th century. One of his comments was, as a child, he realized when he basically said that he was Scottish, he got a different reaction than if he said, oh, my folks came from Canada. And that made a big difference. And I'm wondering the removing of the hyphen seems to, for some people, has made a less tolerant society. And Paul will pick on you because I think you're the only one sitting at the table who are at least the first or second generation of a hyphen.
But that's so distressing to hear you say that, Fred, because
don't shoot the messenger.
because that's so un-American from my perspective, from all I was taught and how I was raised. If anything, if one is to embrace, what is to be an American? Okay, is it the learning about hot dogs and baseball, which my parents embraced? Is it about celebrating Thanksgiving, which they were proud to do? No, what they kept coming back to was, oh, this is such a great country because people accept each other. They accept their differences. They celebrate their differences. And they said, this is something we need to aspire to. We came from countries. So, you know, Americans, wonderful thing about us, we can be self-critical. We are trying to, as Sam said, right our wrongs. That is what makes us, I think, uniquely American. Yes, we have a history with blemishes on it that we're trying to overcome and recognize. But honestly, to think that someone, because they no longer appreciate their ethnic background, whatever it was, now should become actually more closed-minded, that's un-American. You go back to our founding fathers, which everybody likes to talk about, and yes, they were privileged white males, but they did embrace the ideals of individual liberty, of self-realization, and tolerance. I mean, that's really what it was all about to them, and that's what we were founded on. I don't want to see us lose that, because that to me is what defines us as Americans and makes us very unique in the history of humanity.
I'm going to pass this to Steve, but I guess I'm going to pass it to you with a little bit of an observation. And if you decide you don't want to go with it, that's fine. Paul brings up a very good point, and I would like to say I can admire that from the society I live in, but I'm skeptical of some of it because one of the most early abused parts of this country were the indigenous peoples by the originally founding fathers. So the founders of the United States were not very kind to their hosts. And I'm wondering whether or not that's something we've ever recovered from.
That's a fair question. I mean, I think in some sense, no, right? We always have that. And one of the things I tell my students is that we choose our history to tell. I mean, we could tell a history of America that we began with freedom-loving, tolerant Christians who came to America and held hands with the Native Americans and sang Kumbaya during the first Thanksgiving and all that. Or we could tell the story of we had a bunch of religious eccentrics in Europe who couldn't get along with other people there, so they came here and fought each other when they weren't fighting the Native Americans. I mean, it's our history to tell. And I think part of what Dr. Paul was trying to mention is, as Americans, we choose to elevate our higher nature, our better angels, and to say this is who we want to be, even as we look back and say we haven't always lived up to that. And that self-criticism is part of our identity. And I wonder, though, with you know your point that I think it is accurate, that so oftentimes when you lose the hyphen, you become less tolerant. I wonder if it's just we have such bad memories. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're not good at history. We forget who we are, and then the repercussions are we fall into old patterns.
I mean, if I could follow up on that point, I think that that's very kind of explicitly mirrored in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, that they're happening kind of so close to the site of the American Indian movement's takeover of the town of Wounded Knee. Right, we have these kind of very contemporary rights movements that maybe 50, 60 years ago, but we're already kind of forgetting the lessons of, you know, that we have Americans, Native Americans, African Americans, Mexican Americans, that I think to a certain extent we owe some sort of, something to. We owe rights to, we owe whatever it might be. And I think that for us to really have such short memories does us a disservice in seeing a kind of more complete picture of America.
Well, since some of us at the table are older than you are, some of us three times as old as you are,
yes.
It's good that your memory is shorter than ours, but it's a frustrating process, and I think it's for a lot of people it's still a frustrating process. I'm reminded that we've not treated immigrants well. Mm-hmm. We've often not treated immigrants well. But the process by which we consider people alien members of our society, I believe, has evolved. My personal opinion is it hasn't evolved well.
Yeah.
There was a time at which to become a legal resident of the United States only pretty much required that you didn't come here with a criminal record and live on the street. And if you did that long enough, you were a welcome member of society. Now we talk about the people who came here illegally. I'm wondering how we sort that out. I'm surprised, and not pleasantly surprised, by the level of anger that has kind of boiled over in the last couple of years. No one seems to complain about the person washing their dishes at the restaurant, but they complain about the fact that they shouldn't live here. Mm-hmm. And they don't complain about the individual who hired them, who is probably a legal resident in some format. So I don't know how we balance that out. And that's a question I pose to all three of you. If you see that as something we can evolve through, because I don't think we've learned our lesson yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that scapegoating, especially during challenging times, like economically and socially, we're in a challenging time. Scapegoating is not an American thing per se. It's a human thing. Everybody seems to – every group seems to do that. What's different, I think, in America is that we hopefully over time are self-critical of it. And what's foundational to America is our diversity. Is our coming together, our melting potness. And so in the end, our melting pot includes more and more people. It's a struggle to get there, I think. But unlike on the other nations who share a long racial or ethnic history together and at least an attachment to a particular place, all we share is an ideal and a decision to live together. And that's a very different basis for self-identity. I see that as our nation evolves, yes, we struggle with it. And there we have these periods of intolerance and periods of othering that inevitably happens. But hopefully the trajectory is towards a more perfect union of diverse souls.
Yeah, good point. I want to remind you that this is a call-in program. If you'd like to participate in the discussion, the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. This is Community Public Radio, KCBX, and we'd like you to be part of that community if you choose to. We have a fascinating topic today. We're basically talking about what it means to be an American, probably the most nebulous topic that hopefully everybody has an opinion about that we've ever had. My guests today are Paul Georgiou, Dr. Steve Lloyd Moffat, and Sam Holzer. And we're really looking at this as best we can. Sam, back to you. Does the topic of in a political year, and without getting into the politics and the sides of the politics, but especially I think in a political year, does the dialogue among students involve they're pleased with where the country's going, they're shocked where the country's going, or they're shocked about things people are saying?
I think that's a very applicable point. I think that a lot of students are, to a certain extent, fighting over whose history we should be celebrating. I think, as Steve talked about earlier, that there are multiple histories to America. And if we have a history of America that does nothing but kind of laud our achievements and downplay our faults, then I think that we can have a very kind of different vision of where the country's going. I'm often reminded of what President Barack Obama said at one of his speeches, that America is an experiment in democracy, that we might get that experiment wrong, or the hypothesis might be wrong, and we might use, you know, the wrong chemicals or the wrong methods, but that we can continue to experiment. We can continue to potentially find new formulations for coming together. And I would hope that we would have kind of a more diverse and expansive history of America that includes more voices in it.
Okay. We do have a caller, and I want to make sure. Let's see. Rick, are you on the line there?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. You're on the air. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I just kind of tuned in and caught the last part of this, and I wanted to throw a question to your panel, to everybody here listening. That is, in America today, we have a real, you know, turmoil politically. It's obvious to anybody who's watching what's going on. And I notice that there's a lot of this attention towards the policing in America and towards what's going on. And my question to everyone is this. Do you think that we're actually focusing on the wrong situation here, and that we should be focusing towards the unions and the police trainings and the places that give this type of policing to citizens, and would we be better served if we didn't have so much activism to the streets? Because I am an activist, but I take my activism to the courts, and I have found that I get greater success going to my target rather than to the targeting of an individual or a group. For example, San Luis Obispo Police Department. These are good people. These are solid citizens. I think, you know, there's room for training. So I focus my activism on where I really get the best bang for my time and my money. And you mentioned Keystone, you mentioned the pipeline, what's going on in the Dakotas. I have sent friends who are there, and I know people that are there. We've sent blankets and food. But I choose to do my activism from the courtroom. And I think if everybody that was there filed suit, you'd understand how powerful it is to take your message to the system that can actually hear you, rather than seeming to be a puppeteer of some agenda, you know, Black Lives Matter or something, you know. So that's my question here.
Okay. I would like to make it a little bit more nebulous topic if I can, and I want to check with you first, and that is I would like to maybe have the discussion about what types of of movements for social change or societal change are most effective.
Sure.
Okay.
I can
thanks.
Go there.
Okay. Alrighty. I'll have my guests chat about it. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Alrighty.
Yeah, I mean, I often, you know, look at the current disagreements and discussion in the public square, and it can be really demoralizing. I mean, I get everybody has a different take, and they're very passionate about it, especially online. But one of the things that I would point out is that, look, in the end, we're still dialoguing, while in other places when there's disagreements. And historically, when there's been disagreements, they kill each other. And I think part of being American is this process that we agree to move forward, you know, as best we can nonviolently. Now, there has been violence in the past, definitely, without a doubt. There's been targeting, and as the caller mentioned, of police and of protesters. There has been violence. But overall, given all the heated rhetoric, one of the things that I think is great is that we can still have this dialogue without hurting each other overall. And so I would say to the caller, hey, if he wants to work through the courts, that's great. If other people want to protest on the street, that's great too. We can go through many, many different channels. That's part of our country. But the important thing is that as we evolve as a nation, that we agree to do it in ways that are learning from the violent ways of the past or separating ourselves from that.
Absolutely. If I could follow up, my lawyer mother loves to bring up the point that we are a nation of laws.
Okay. And for clarification, what you were saying is my mother, who happens to be a lawyer.
Yes. Okay, yeah, that was
okay.
That was.
You ran it together quickly enough. I wanted to just make sure we understood that correctly.
Phrased
okay.
A little clunkily. but yeah, she loves to bring up the point that we are a nation of laws, and my naive 22-year-old self often retorts that we are a participatory democracy. And so I think if we could balance those two out, right, if we can have people in the streets and understand that they are, right, exerting their right to organization, to protest, to free speech, but at the same time understand that one of the ways that we make kind of substantial applicable change is through the court system, is through the legislative process, is through the judicial process, excuse me, I think both of those in tandem often are the most kind of effective procedures. I don't really think you can have one without the other.
I think it's a very good point. And as you were saying that, what occurred to me is that those with a large enough bank account to hire the lawyers basically generally take their claims to the legal system. Those who have more time and energy but less financial resources are more likely to take things to the streets. And I think that's why a good portion of the people that we see in any kind of challenging or civil disobedience protest seem to be either very young people or very old people. And there's nothing wrong with either of those groups of people, but one of them has more time on their hands than money, and the other one is retired, looking for, in lots of cases, where to focus their energy. So I think that becomes a balancing act that's kind of tough to work through. Any other thoughts?
No, I just think that both Stephen and Sam have clarified, this is part of our American ethic. It really is. That belief that as hard it is to face these issues that we're struggling with and are going to continue coming up, every generation is going to have to face them, that we have a spirit and even a system that can address them, that we're going to keep moving forward, at least, and we'll never lose that aspiration. I think that's part of the definition of being an American.
Yeah. Very good point. Thank you. We have another caller. Let me see here. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks for your patience.
Well,
jump
first
on in.
Of all, I want to thank you for having a discussion that can promote positive thoughts and ideas, and where you're not stepping all over one another, as we hear so much in the debates. You are offering positive supports and positive solutions. I am so discouraged by a single voice trying to promote fear and danger all over our country in so many different ways, and stating that one voice is the only one that can solve everything, and can gain control over everything and can fire anybody he wants to because that's business. Business may have a place for what he has learned, but it does not have a place in democracy.
Okay.
That's all I can say.
Very good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. There's an interesting part to that comment that I would like to maybe have us look at, and that is that I think as a society we forget that oftentimes we challenge people whose points of view we don't agree with, and do very little to talk to the people who agree with that point of view. Candidate R, whoever that may be, may be supported by 7 million people. And everybody wants to challenge candidate R, whoever candidate R may be, but they don't want to have a talk or a conversation with the supporters of candidate R. And I'm wondering whether or not that lack of dialogue is just human nature of Homo sapiens or an element of our democracy that that we don't want to really look at. We want to follow a given point of view, but we don't want to talk about it or defend it.
I mean, what I would say it's not only who we talk to, but where we learn about our world that has become more separated. I mean, in some ways, just as a religious historian, I see us sort of going back to the Middle Ages, not in some ways through the means of getting information, where one of the things about the Middle Ages was everybody got all their information from the church. That was the only source of information. And it seems like now we've sort of balkanized into all these little fiefdoms where one group gets all their information from Fox and another group gets it just from MSNBC and one group only gets it from this website and that website. And so that we don't have the common basis to have the conversations that we used to be able to have. I mean, I'm not it's the new media world in which there's a million websites and a million television stations. You know, it's good in many, many ways, but it has allowed us to get into our bunkers much more easily. And so one of the things I've noticed is that it used to be that we could agree on how the world is, you know, the facts of the world, and disagree on how to make it better. But I see what happens so often now is we actually disagree with what's going on in the world. We disagree with basic facts. We disagree with data. And there's whole groups that become suspicious of studies or academics or things, so that we can't come together on what the world is right now, and thus by the time we get to that second level, how do we make it better? We don't have the shared basis in data to then have meaningful discussion. So I think part of the lack of discussion is the fact that we've evolved into a world in which we're all seeing different worlds. We all have our own glasses on, and at one point they were pretty similar lenses, and now we've just got such different lenses, it's hard for us to come together to have meaningful conversations.
We tend to challenge whether or not the people who may be able to clarify for some of us are valid. You're familiar with Snopes.com?
Yes.
Okay. A website that's done a very good job of, for lack of a better way of putting it, dispelling urban myths and things like that for a while. And as it's become more of a truth-checking white website, if you go to their site now, you'll actually notice that there's a clarification as to who has or has not ever supported financially that website, because there's been an ongoing dialogue of people who are saying, oh, because they print too much that disagrees with what I believe is true, then X political group or X group of wealthy benefactors must be supporting them. We tend to trust no one, I guess, and that does concern me. I don't know how we address that as a society. Mm-hmm. Not who do we trust, but how do we build a consensus as to what we can have mutual trust for, even if we disagree on things?
I mean, I think if you can appreciate the founding fathers for anything, they were very well educated people. That they were some of the only college educated individuals at the time. And I think that an education in critical reasoning and the ability to fact check and clarify and understand multiple nuanced points of view, not as, you know, complete black and white disagreements, but as multiple shades of gray in a world that often has kind of multiple ways of telling different versions of the truth, that's, you know, what I would see as one of the most necessary things moving forward.
Good point. We do have another caller. I don't want to keep them waiting too long. Sorry. Okay, see, Mike from Atascadero, you there?
I'm here.
Thanks for your patience.
Okay, I've got a lot of patience. Why not?
Okay, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Several things here that may not even be connected with each other, but the first thing here is that when you portray people immigrating to the United States in movies and films and stuff, it always is this coming to America for a better life and, freedom and all this kind of stuff. And what is never, ever really talked about is maybe even more people are come here so that there could be cheap labor. And the price of labor can be pushed down, and therefore there's more profits for businesses and stuff like that. And it's not all this, you know, emotional love for these things here, because the majority of my background is Irish, and most of the Irish came over here during the famine in the 1840s, and my Irish forebears came here in 1841, just before that. But the point is that all of a sudden there were all these Irish people there, and that was great because they were doing all the cheap labor. Then there's a recession in the 1850s, and the Know Nothing Party appears, and they were completely derogatory. They wanted to get rid of immigrants. That's when the famous "No Irish Need Apply" signs, you know, started popping up on businesses and stuff like that. And so it's not just that. It's just there was a wave of German immigrants. A lot of them came here for freedom. That was after the revolutions in Europe in 1848, and they came here to escape a lot of that. But what was really strange, if you look in history, that in the Civil War, you know, remember they had that $300 you could get out of having to fight, okay? And you go into any military cemetery that's connected with the Civil War, you will see most of the dead have Irish or German names. And they didn't have a high, connection to power. Some of them, who knows, some of them may fought because they could get $300. Some of them fought that if they thought they might be able to get a better life. Well, my ancestor, who was in the Union Army, got a severe case of dysentery from which he never recovered, and he died later on. And he was just much of a casualty of the Civil War as if he had gotten shot. So this celebration of the land of America is all this, greatness and all this stuff. I don't see it, and I don't see it today. That's for damn sure. I think the United States is more about who has power, and what is what is power? Power is about who has it and what they do with it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this is used to exclude people rather than include people. And like, especially I was a couple of years ago, I developed a friendship with a Mexican American kid who was trying to go to college, and I told him, my family were peasants, and I told him, the Irish were the Mexicans of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so he was looking at me like, what?
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that. And I see exploitation more, even greater than the Lady of the Lamp. I've certainly seen pictures of the Statue of Liberty at night, and it's beautiful. And, give me your tile, masses huddled, the debris free and all that. That's part of it. But that's the only part of it that ever seems to be celebrated instead of the truth. And I can go back to I actually have mixed heritage of Irish and Brit, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And the Brit part were Puritans,
yeah,
who came in here in the great decade of the 1630s, and because they were all trying to escape oppression in England. But then they turned around and started oppressing the people around them because they their religion was supposed to be the perfect religion and all this.
Mike, you bring up some good points. Let me let my guests jump in here. Thanks for
the call.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. I think Mike does bring up some very good points, and that is that it there's still a tremendous amount of it that's financially motivated. But the ability to succeed, the ability to provide for your family and your community is basic nature. We're a society that that focuses on some form of barter for services in order to survive. My thought is it's not any different than it was 100 years ago. Is there any effort you think to make it different than it was 100 years ago?
Well, I think that Mike's point is perfectly valid. And thanks, Mike. You take a historical approach. This is nothing new what we're going through. So please, Fred, don't be so disheartened about the political dialogue that's going on right now. America has survived this before, will survive it again. Mike's talking about a horrible war that our country went through to address historical wrongs. And we moved forward. Another thing, you alluded to the discrimination towards maybe your immigrant ancestors. I certainly know Sam's did. And I would talk to older generations of Greeks. It was dictated where they had to live, what they could do. Their kids couldn't go to a certain university. And you know what? That chip on their shoulder that they had as a result of it was actually helped push them. That was their drive to prove they were not only going to be Americans, they were going to be the best Americans. They were going to be the contributing ones to society. So, yes, this is part of our history. We should look at it with open eyes that we've exploited immigrants. We continue to. We stigmatize them. And yet, they, unlike so many other societies here, we can aspire to lose that hyphen that Stephen's been talking about.
Yeah, I would add to that. I was very appreciative of Sam bringing up Obama talking about how this is a great experiment, because I think it is. And we have these real negative aspects of the exploitation of capitalism, and we have positive ones too. I think the positive parts sometimes I will get lost on as you criticize it. But my partner and I were down in L.A. A few months ago, and we went to Ontario Mills, which is a big mall, and I can't stand malls. But I had the most interesting experience there, because we walked in and I said, Amy, we're the only white people here. I mean, there were thousands of people of all kinds. I mean, there were African-Americans, but there were also burqa-wearing Muslim-Americans. There were Indians wearing saris. There were Asian-Americans. And I was like, this is what America is, America is now. And it's beautiful, and it's great. And the beautiful thing about it was, what was uniting them in the end? Capitalism. Yeah. I mean, it was bizarre. It's like
they were in a mall.
The only fights they were going to have were whether they could get the new iPhone or not.
Yeah.
And the teller at H&M didn't ask, is your money different from anybody else's money?
Good
and so
point.
There's this odd side also that capitalism is bringing people together, uniting people. I mean, most of those people back in generations past, perhaps, before they immigrated, would have been fighting each other. And now they're just, worried about a parking spot and a shopping bag. And that there's something beautiful about that, as distressing it is when you look at the sort of the crass capitalism that's behind it.
Sometimes the crassness sometimes gives us encouragement.
Yeah.
Understood, yeah. Okay, let me go. Mike, thanks for waiting. We have Mike from Goleta here. We only have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Jump on in.
My question is along the same lines. In the United States, one of the values that we have is equality of opportunity, and this idea that we live in some sort of meritocracy where you work hard, you play by the rules, and you get ahead. And I'm wondering how those values might conflict with the goals of capitalism, where there is an equal of opportunity where hopefully in this society we're looking for fair competition, but part of the goals of capitalism is to gather the most wealth and resources, and that might be a conflicting goal of the equality of opportunity.
Well, I guess the bigger question for me, if I may jump into this, is Is there any place else in the world you think you could go to get a balance of the struggle even being allowed to take place?
Sure. I think most of Western Europe has a better balance, where every society would have a balance between the rights and values of the individual versus community. And by having a pure capitalism system, I think we're more focused on the individual than what's best for a society. So you lose things such as healthcare and strong unions and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Thanks for the call, Mike.
Thank you. Okay.
We've only got a few minutes left. Steve, jump on in.
Yeah. I mean, in my academic work, I often look at happiness studies. And if you look at the international happiness studies, the countries that our caller was talking about are the happiest countries, Denmark, Iceland. Northern Europe, in studies, show the happiness. But they're also the most homogenous countries in the world. So, yeah, you can create those environments, but do it in try it with diversity. That's the challenge behind our grand experiment, is how do we get all these people who come from different cultures and different backgrounds and different expectations and different understandings of what it means to be human and what our goals are in life. How do you bring them all together and make them happy? How do you bring them together and create a society that supports them? And so, yes, we can point to places in Europe where they have a greater social net and the results are in studies a happier country, but they're not diverse. And that's what makes, America, I think, so fascinating, is that we're trying to do something that other countries have not done, and that is to create a genuinely diverse culture together.
And I would suggest the fact that we can still have this discussion and we don't have to look out the window to wonder who's going to come get us for having it is probably a big factor, too. We have a few minutes left, and as I always promise my guests, that I will get out of the way a little bit and give you folks a chance to talk about maybe what we haven't talked about here. Paul, why don't we start with you?
Actually, this has been broad-ranging, much more than I'd expected, Fred, because we've touched on everything from not only ethics and as well as ethnography, or people who have all come from, but even some of our economic models as well. You know what? That's all evolving too. So to go back to the question of economically, how are we driven? How are we structured? I'm sorry, you have to just go back to the robber barons in our history. That's why I like to take a historical perspective. It's not the first time in America we've had terrible separation between those who are struggling and the working classes versus those who are extremely wealthy. But somehow America finds its way. Yes, I believe we're an experiment that's evolving, and it's because we can evolve, unlike some other very rigid societies, that we're going to make it through this. And actually, America, I think, will continue to be a beacon of hope. The other question, though, about individuality, that's one of the things I do admire about Americans, is that we still admire the individual. Those who've got the courage to stand up for what they believe is right and to be able to speak it openly. And Fred, you're right. It's pretty unique to being an American.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I thank KCBX for hosting these events, because the dialogue is so important. And I think especially in times like today, where we're so divided seemingly in political seasons, we forget that actually we share so many common ideals. And whether you're Democrat or Republican or somewhere in between, if you actually sort of ask questions that aren't strictly political, we share so much in common. And really, it's getting to know each other better. We come to realize that. So oftentimes, I spend a lot of time lecturing on Islam in the community. And I get a lot of flack from it. And people come in and say, well, they want this, they want that. And I said, do you know the Muslims in your community? Because they're such wonderful examples of being Muslim and being American. I mean, they're so great. And they say, wow, your Muslim students do this. I'm advisor for the Muslim Student Association. I say, go on the Muslim Student Association Facebook page. What are they doing there? They're not wearing turbans and protesting or anything. It's them at the end of a football game excited. It's them doing public service in our community. It's them, having bonfires together, debating Disney movies or whatever they do. They're just Americans. And they're some of the brightest and best examples of being American. And so I think so oftentimes we can polarize ourselves and balkanize into different viewpoints and stuff. But there is something that's fundamentally good, I think, when we get to know each other in our community and see that we do share so much together.
Yeah, very good point. Sam.
Yes.
Okay. As the youngest person here with the perspective of where we might go in the future, mm-hmm. you get the last word.
Well, one thing I think if you can commend any movement that has happened in this political cycle, it is that so many people are concerned about the future of America. I might not agree with where everybody wants America to go. I think that is a part of being American that you have to be a part of this multitude of voices. But I am tremendously excited for this kind of recent participatory democratic experiment. I am hoping that America can continue to tell more nuanced histories about itself, that can continue to reckon with the immigrants who came here, the immigrants that are still here, and the indigenous populations. I know that one thing that has recently become very popular is potentially renaming Christopher Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a further example of the potential broadening of the American hyphenate, that we can be both American and something else, and that does not decrease our value in the eyes of our community any less.
Very good point. Thank you. And I have more confidence in our future when I get to talk to people like you. I think that the things that you share, we sometimes all we hear about is what goes on at a frat party in the media sometimes, and not what goes on with students really thinking about what's going on. So I thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing that with us. I thank you for all listening today. It's been a wonderful program. It's not very often we get to have a topic that is this broad and open to just a general discussion, and thank you to our callers. I want to remind you that this is Central Coast Voices. We're a project of Action for Healthy Communities, a part of the community foundation of San Luis Obispo in its collaboration with KCBX. If you're interested, the Action for Healthy Communities does a report every 3 years. The most recent report was 3 years ago, with a new one coming out in about 2 months. It's available at actionslo.org. It'll give you a snapshot of the economic and social issues of our county and how they're doing, and it's a good way to look at what's going on around you. We all, if you're involved in a program like this, listen to what's going on around you, or you wouldn't be listening to a program like this today. But there's further information available, and I invite you to go look at that study. Next week, Central Coast Voices host Chris Kington Barker will be back, and she has an interesting topic. October is Domestic Violence Prevention Month. And Chris' guests will include folks from the SAFER program at Cal Poly, joining them as they talk about the importance of teaching healthy masculinity, especially as a tool in preventing sexual assault on women. And this is basically something we need to look at a little further. I want to clarify, this is just for the record, this program was planned well in advance of any of the things in the news media in the last 6 days. This is a topic that is here because it is Domestic Violence Prevention Month in October. As I've said before, this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities. This program is underwritten by a grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. And thank you to my guests, Paul, Steve, and Sam today. This has been Central Coast Voices.